Welcome to the Golden Age of Comic Books. It's June 12, 2005. Welcome everybody to the show. This is Bill Jourdain, your host. We're really glad you're here today. We're going to start the show today talking a little bit about 1938, the year that the Golden Age of Comics began, and some of the things that were going on in the world during that year. We're then going to talk about another of the DC Archive editions, one that came out in January of this year that contained some very rare and very exciting Golden Age of Comics material. We're then going to talk a little bit about the Golden Age marketplace, how Golden Age comic books have been selling, both in some auctions and in some private sales. We're then going to talk about Golden Age artist, the one and only Jerry Robinson, a fantastic Golden Age artist. We're going to detail some of his accomplishments in the Golden Age of comics. And finally, we are extremely fortunate to have with us today on the show Roy Thomas. Roy is one of the greats of Golden Age comic book fandom, a wonderful comic book writer in his own right, and someone who everyone looks up to when we talk about the Golden Age of comics. So without further ado, we'll get on with the show. Okay, well, let's talk about 1938, the year that the Golden Age of comics began. That year, in 1938, the best picture was You Can't Take It With You. Other popular movies in 1938 were Boys Town, Dodge City, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Gunga Din, and Pygmalion. Germany seized Austria on March 12, 1938, and as you all know, the war was looming and the march to World War II was rapidly approaching. Also, in 1938, on June 25th, the Fair Labor Standards Act established the first minimum wage at 25 cents an hour. Could barely buy you a comic book after working for an hour. In July, Howard Hughes set a new around-the-world record, 3 days, 19 hours, and 8 minutes in a Lockheed 14N Super Electra aircraft. And in the aircraft industry, Boeing, in December, introduced a Stratoliner. It was the first aircraft with a pressurized cabin. Speaking of drama, Thornton Wilder, in 1938, won the Pulitzer Prize in drama for Our Town. And the Golden Gate Bridge and the Hoover Dam were both completed in 1938. Now, if you wanted to buy a car in 1938, and a really nice car, you could get a 1938 convertible Cadillac sedan for just about $4,000. So there you go. If you wanted a nice Cadillac in 1938, that's what it would cost you. And of course, most importantly for those of us involved in the Golden Age of comics, in 1938, you could plop down a shiny dime and pick yourself up a copy of Action Comics number 1 with the first appearance of Superman. Now, for a dime, you'd get a pristine copy of Action Comics number 1 in 1938. Think about what it would cost you today. Okay, let's talk about another of the DC Comics Archives editions. In our last podcast, we talked about a couple of DC Archives that had recently come out. Let's talk about one that came out in January of 2005, the DC Comics Archives Rarities Edition. This book was a lot bigger than the usual archive editions, 348 big pages, pretty big book compared to the others, and it had a big price to go with it, a $75 cover price, but I've seen them on the internet for $45 to $60, so you probably won't have to pay full cover price for this archive edition. This book reprints three of the probably most sought after and very rare comics of the Golden Age. It reprints New York World's Fair number 1939. It reprints New York World's Fair from 1940. And it reprints the Big All-American comic book from 1944. Only three books, but these books, when they were put out, were very large and had a lot of material in them, so they encompass 348 pages in the archive. So let's start out by talking about the 1939 New York World's Fair comic. This book was first published by DC on April 30th, 1939, to coincide with the opening of the 1939 World's Fair in New York City. As I mentioned, this book was large. It was 100 pages with cardboard covers. It's a notable book as having the first published appearance of the Sandman. Now, his first drawn appearance is in Adventure Comics number 40, but this was the first book in which the Sandman's adventures were published. It's also notable as having a Superman cover with a blind-headed Superman. Probably a mistake, but certainly the only time that I know of in the Golden Age that Superman appeared with blonde hair. Now, his story on the inside, he did have his normal black hair. The book was priced at 25 cents, and it didn't sell very well because you could go out and buy a 64-page comic for 10 cents. Recognizing this and realizing the poor sales the book was having, DC later printed 15-cent stickers and put them on the remaining books and sold them for that price. This book was jam-packed with information about the 1939 World's Fair. Almost every story in the book featured a picture of the Trilon and Perisphere, which were the Art Deco symbols of the World's Fair. If you look at the stories, I think they went out of their way to make sure that the Trilon and Perisphere were featured in almost every single angle you could see them at. In addition to superhero appearances, the book features many text pieces with the history of fairs generally and information about this particular fair. With respect to superheroes and other characters, the book features Superman, Chuck Warren, Hanko the Cowhand, Butch the Pup, Ginger Snap, Scoop Scanlan, Slam Bradley, the Sandman, as I mentioned, and Zatara the Magician, all making appearances at the New York World's Fair for 1939. Siegel and Shuster, who created Superman, were responsible for two stories in this book. They, of course, did the Superman story that's the first story in the book, and also the Slam Bradley story, Slam Bradley, of course, being their creation, who first appeared in Detective Comics number 1. Each story in this archive edition in the world, the 1939 World's Fair reprint, is similar in that it has some element of crime fighting that takes place in and around the fair, and the Superman story even features him using his superpowers to complete on an expedited basis one of the pavilions, I would say at record speed. He was really a one-man construction crew in that story. The feature, A Day at the World's Fair, by Craig Flessel, depicts a couple of kids and their Uncle George walking through about every major exhibit at the fair, so if you're interested about what the 1939 World's Fair looked like or what it was about, that story will give you a pretty good idea about the major exhibits and what was happening at the fair. Of course, missing from this book is Batman. There is no Batman story in the 1939 World's Fair book because there was no Batman at the time. Bob Kane has drawn the Ginger Snap feature in the book, but this was a few months before he created with Bill Finger Batman and that Batman became a reality. So let's move forward now to the 1940 World's Fair comic. The World's Fair that started in 1939 continued on into the autumn of 1940 when I believe the gates were closed at that time. But on May 11th, 1940, DC decided to publish a second World's Fair comic book, priced at 15 cents. This book also had 100 pages, and it had cardboard covers like the 1939 book. The 1940 edition was notable for featuring Superman, Batman, and Robin on the cover. This is the very first time that these three characters appeared together. This was a precursor to the many, many cover appearances by Batman, Superman, and Robin on the covers of World Best number 1 and then World's Finest starting with number 2 and going on for about 300 issues from there. So, again, a very notable and important aspect of that book is that cover appearance of those three characters, as was the case with World's Best and World's Finest until the issues in the early 50s. Batman and Robin and Superman did not appear together in the stories. The comic book, 1940 World's Fair comic, features stories that tend to focus less on the fair, as was the case in the 1939 book, and more on action away from the fair. This issue features appearances by Superman, Red, White, and Blue, Hanko the Cowhand, Slam Bradley, Zatara, Hourman, Catnip the Cat, Speedy Sam the Taxi Man, the Sandman, Johnny Thunderbolt, Ginger Snap, and Batman and Robin. With the exception for the story A Day at the Fair, these were all new stories and different from the 1939 book. So if you're interested in learning a little bit of history about the 1939 and 1940 World's Fair in New York, or if you're interested in seeing some historical appearances of some major Golden Age characters, either on covers or in stories, then this reprint book, this DC Comics Rarities edition, would be an excellent addition to your comics library. But that's not all. Also in this book was a reprint of the Big All-American Comic Book. And when they say big, they weren't kidding. This 128-page book was published in 1944 by All-American and was 25 cents. 128 pages was just absolutely huge for this time frame, double the size of most comic books of the time. And this book featured almost every single All-American hero of the day. In this book, you'll find stories with Wonder Woman, Scribbly, The Atom, The Blue Boys, Johnny Thunder, Hop Harrigan, The Whip, Pint-Size Pete, Green Lantern, Ghost Patrol, Mr. Terrific, Wildcat, Hawkman, Bulldog Drumhead, The Flash, and some Mutt and Jeff strips. All of the stories in the Big All-American Comic Book are typical of the mid-40s Golden Age superhero stories, but I particularly enjoyed the Flash, Green Lantern, and Hawkman stories. The Green Lantern story features a Medusa-type story where a blackmailer are apparently turning citizens into stone, and I won't spoil the story for you, but that's the basis of the story. Pretty interesting premise and pretty well-done story. The Flash story is a typical Golden Age Flash story. This one is called The Million Dollar Apple. It involved gem smuggling and some other issues like that, and I thought it was well done and certainly worth reading. Most notably about this issue, though, is the Hawkman story. Why is it notable? Well, it's notable because it's the first Hawkman rendering by Joe Kubert. Joe Kubert had, of course, rendered Hawkman for many, many years, starting in the Golden Age, and is well known for his rendition of Hawkman. However, this appearance in the Big All-American Comic Book is Joe Kubert's very first effort and a wonderful job of telling a Hawkman tale. That really, in my opinion, is a good enough reason to go out and buy this archive book. The story that Joe did features a tale of a villain who could only survive in extreme hot temperatures, kind of a Mr. Freeze in reverse. So I found it real interesting, and I think you will too, and I would recommend that you go out and get that book, if for no other reason than to see Joe Kubert's first rendition of Hawkman. Now, if you were to go out today and attempt to find the three original books that are reprinted in this DC Comics Rarities edition in mid-grade, they would probably set you back $15,000 or $20,000, so even paying the cover price of $75 seems like a bargain for this huge collection of classic Golden Age material. If you're interested in picking up a copy of the DC Comics Rarities edition, I know that it's still available in most comic shops, having only come out in January of this year. It's also available from many online sources, including Amazon. Okay, let's turn to our market report and talk a little bit about some Golden Age comic books that have sold in auctions and through some private sales. First of all, Metropolis Comics has reported that an Action Comics 69 from February 1944 in very fine near-mint condition sold for $1,200 through their private selling. That has a prankster cover, something that we talked about in our last show. They also reported that a Superman number 3, graded CGC 7.0, which is the winter 1939 issue of that comic, sold for $4,300, so a pretty big sale there. They reported a big sale, a Superman number 1, in good condition from the summer of 1939, the first appearance of that comic book, Superman number 1, sold for $17,000, so a pretty good price for a good copy of that comic. Metropolis also reported that they have made some purchases and they now have these books for sale. First of all, they reported a couple of copies of Batman number 1. The first one is graded VG Fine 5.0, and they've got it listed on their website as $27,000. And they have a very fine 8.0 copy of Batman number 1 with no price, and they indicated that you should just call if you're interested in that book. So obviously, it would be more than $27,000. Batman number 1 not only is a key issue because it's the first appearance of that particular title, but it also represents the first appearance of the Joker, the probably the most important villain in the Golden Age of comics, and also the first appearance of Catwoman. So if you want to go out and spend $27,000, give Metropolis a call, and I'm sure they'll sell you that 5.0 Batman number 1. As in our last show, CBG, Comic Buyer's Guide, has reported some auction results. First of all, they reported on the Hakes number 183 auction. They reported an Adventure Comics number 41, CGC 9.6, and this is the Mile High Edgar Church Collection issue of that comic. The August 1939 issue sold for a whopping $23,000. Now, this is the highest graded copy of Adventure Comics number 41, CGC 9.6, so a real key issue and a real beautiful book, I'm sure. This cover features an adventure-type cover with a shark on it and a diver. So, an interesting book and a real high grade, I'm sure, one that we'd all like to see. They reported from the Hakes auction a Captain America number 6 sold. That's the September 1941 issue for $11,110. That book was from the San Francisco Pedigree Collection, but the CBG and Hakes did not report a grade for that book in their magazine. They also reported a copy of Submariner number 14 from the fall of 1944, another San Francisco Pedigree book, sold for $9,815. Again, no grade was given for that book. Finally, the Hakes auction reported in the CBG an All Winners number 12 from the spring of 1942, sold for $9,224, another San Francisco Pedigree book, and again, no grade was given for that book. So some really high prices on some apparently very nice books there in that particular Hakes auction. CBG reported some other auctions and some results, so let's talk about those for just a moment. First of all, they reported Daredevil Battles Hitler. That's actually Daredevil Comics number 1, but it's called Daredevil Battles Hitler. A CGC 4.0 copy sold for only $622. That July 1941 issue has a Adolf Hitler photo cover. So a book that you've seen represented a lot, I'm sure, in some of the price guides and other Golden Age comic book resources, but it didn't get a real high price in this particular auction. Two books were reported that were actually on the newsstand during the same period of time in 1941. First of all, Captain America number 15 in 9.0 sold for $4,972. That October 1941 issue featured the Red Skull in his third appearance. At the same time, on the newsstands in October and November of 1941, was Batman number 7. This issue was a 9.0, and it sold for $4,050. This is one of the very recognizable copies of Batman. This has the red and white bullseye cover on the front with Batman slugging a criminal in the center of the bullseye. A pretty neat cover. Also reported was a sale of Flash Comics number 1 in 5.5 for $5,100. This January 1940 issue features the first appearance of the Golden Age Flash and the first appearance of the Golden Age Hawkman, along with the first appearance of the Golden Age Johnny Thunder, a key book for a key price. They reported a sale of Superman number 2 from the fall of 1939 in CGC 8.0 for $15,500, another very sought-after book in high grade. An interesting book that sold, World's Finest number 3 in CGC 3.5, sold for $390. Now, this autumn 1941 issue of World's Finest features a really neat Fred Ray baseball cover. It's got a cover cover art with Batman, Robin, and Superman playing baseball. A real recognizable and very, very good cover if you're interested in the Golden Age of comics and covers featuring Batman, Superman, and Robin. What's interesting about this book also is it features the first appearance of the Scarecrow, one of the supervillains that Batman faced only a couple of times during the Golden Age, but who was resurrected in the Silver Age, and who will be featured in the upcoming movie Batman Begins that may be out in theaters at the time that you're listening to this podcast. So, World's Finest number 3 for $390 with the first appearance of the Scarecrow. Heritage Comics Auction on their website listed a few comics that they sold. First of all, a Wonder Comics number 13 from 1947, graded CGC 8.0 for $460. This has a really great Alex Schomburg airbrush cover. A copy of Batman number 49, graded CGC 5.0, was reported to have sold in their auction for $488.75. This October-November 1948 issue features a Joker cover. Joker appears as a genie coming out of a lamp on the cover, and the cover story is a Carter Nichols story. If you recall, I discussed Carter Nichols in our last podcast. Finally, Heritage Comics reported the sale of Gene Autry Comics number 1, pretty low-grade book, CGC 1.5. It sold for $341.55. This December 1941 issue features the first appearance of Gene Autry and Champion in comic books. The Overstreet Price Guide lists this as a rare book. So there you have it, number of Golden Age sales over the last couple of months. As I pointed out in the last podcast, and as you've seen here from this report, the sales of Golden Age comics continue to be very, very brisk, and I would imagine that that trend will continue during the course of the summer convention season and the auctions that are currently ongoing on eBay, Heritage, and other sources. Today we're going to talk about Golden Age artist Jerry Robinson. Jerry was born in 1922 in New York, and in 1939, at the age of 17, he was hired by Bob Kane to be an art assistant on the brand new feature in Detective Comics called Batman. Around 1941, Jerry became the primary artist working on Batman in both Detective Comics and in the comic book Batman. And Jerry, along with Bill Finger, is credited with creating some of the most memorable characters in those two titles. First, they are credited with creating the Golden Age Joker, probably one of the most recognized and important villains of the Golden Age of comics. The Joker was first introduced to the world in Batman number 1 in the spring of 1940. The other character most notable that Bill Finger and Jerry Robinson were credited with creating is Robin the Boy Wonder. Robin was introduced in Detective Comics 38 in April 1940. The creation of Robin marked a change in the direction of Batman, who now had a youthful sidekick, and quite frankly, the storylines from this point forward in Detective and then in Batman were softened quite a bit. Jerry created some of my favorite Golden Age Batman covers, and probably some of the best covers of the Golden Age of comics. If you take a look at Batman number 10, that is the classic drawing board cover, where Batman and Robin are standing on a cartoonist drawing board holding pens next to an inkwell. Really a neat cover, and I believe that was Jerry's first cover for Batman. Batman number 12 is a classic World War II cover created by Jerry, with Batman and Robin driving a Jeep and promoting war bonds. Batman 13, a cover we discussed in our last podcast, is a parachute cover. Batman and Robin are parachuting into danger during World War II. Batman number 14, the cover created by Jerry, is a classic Penguin cover. It has Batman and Robin peering into the comic book at Penguin running away with an umbrella with smoke coming out of the end of it. Batman number 17, another cover we talked about briefly in the last podcast, was created by Jerry Robinson. It's a World War II cover promoting war bonds, where Batman and Robin are sitting on the back of a large eagle supporting the war effort. Some of the best covers that Jerry created for the Golden Age of comics can be found in Detective Comics. He created several classic Joker covers, number 62, number 69, number 71, and number 76. All of these are great Joker covers. I would encourage you to go out and find a source to look at these, the Gerber Photo General or other sources for looking at Golden Age comic covers. Number 69 is probably my favorite Jerry Robinson Batman cover. It features, I think, the best depiction of the maniacal nature of the Joker. It has the Joker as a large genie-like figure coming out of a lamp, holding a couple of handguns and threatening Batman and Robin. It's a real sinister Joker cover. And again, depicts, I think, the maniacal nature of that character. One of the best Jerry Robinson covers, in my opinion, of the Golden Age of comics. One of the other great Jerry Robinson covers that you'll find on Detective Comics is on number 70. That is a classic bathysphere cover that has Batman and Robin featured. Robin inside of a bathysphere and Batman on the outside swimming. I think this cover has been recreated and reprinted on many occasions, and it's just a great cover. And if you can find a copy to take a look at, I would encourage you to do so. In addition to his work on Batman and Detective Comics, Jerry worked on other titles during the Golden Age, such as World's Finest, featuring Batman and Robin, The Green Hornet, Green Llama, Gunsmoke Western, Atom Man Comics, More Fun Comics, Action Comics, and Journey into Mystery Comics, just to name a few. After leaving the comic book world, Jerry started the newspaper strip Life with Robinson, and was later president of the National Cartoonist Society from 1967 until 1969. If you are interested in learning more about Jerry Robinson, I would encourage you to pick up a copy of the August 2004 issue of Alter Ego magazine. That's issue number 39. It was devoted almost entirely to Jerry and his life in comics, and has an extensive interview of Jerry. I believe that you can still pick up a copy of that magazine through the publisher's website. Alter Ego is published by Tomorrow's Publications, and the website is tomorrows.com, and that's spelled TWOMORROWS.com, tomorrows.com. In the June 2005 issue of Alter Ego, issue number 49 that just hit the newsstands in the last week, Jerry has announced the creation of the Bill Finger Award for lifetime contribution to the art of comic book writing. This award is designed to have the same stature as the Eisner Awards or some of the other prominent comic industry awards, and will be given to an extraordinary writer/creator of comic books in honor of the genius of Bill Finger, who has been credited as the co-creator of Batman and of Green Lantern. Bill Finger died on January 12, 1974, and was generally unknown, other than in the comic industry, as having been the co-creator of Batman and Green Lantern. In fact, Bob Kane never really gave Finger credit for his contributions to Batman until much, much later. The first Bill Finger Award will be presented at the 2005 San Diego Comic-Con in July at the San Diego Convention Center. So if you're interested in Jerry Robinson, I hope this has been informative for you. And again, I would encourage you to pick up the Alter Ego from August of 2004. It has a lot of good information about Jerry, truly one of the giants in the Golden Age of comics. We're truly fortunate to have Roy Thomas with us today for an interview. As most of you know, Roy has been working in the comic business for 40 years. He started in fandom in the early 60s with Jerry Bale and Alter Ego. He later went to Marvel Comics and worked on a number of titles there. Most notable for him was The Avengers and Conan the Barbarian while he was with Marvel. He then went to DC Comics and worked on such titles as All-Star Squadron and others. Roy has been a driving force in comic book fandom since he again began publishing Alter Ego magazine. Alter Ego is now up to its 49th issue that was published this week, and we'll be having its 50th coming up in July. We're real pleased to have Roy, so here we go with the interview. Well, Roy, thank you so much for being with us here today on the Golden Age of Comics. Roy, it's a well-known fact that next to Jerry Bales, you're probably one of the greatest fans of the Golden Age of comics, and that you have a great love for the adventures of the Justice Society of America. What, in fact, was it, Roy, that turned you on about the Justice Society of America that made it such a lifelong passion and pursuit for you?
I have no conscious knowledge of exactly why, you know, the Justice Society hit me the way it did when I was young and why it has a hold. After all, I saw probably characters like Superman, Batman, maybe a few others, you know, first. And while I continued to like those characters and buy them over the years, it didn't grab me, say, the way, you know, Justice Society did. It was just that idea of a lot of characters being together, which made the comics world seem a little more real to me. Because I quickly became aware that the heroes didn't ever seem to meet each other or know each other or mention each other. And therefore, suddenly seeing seven of them together, as I did in either All-Star 24 or more likely 25, the first one that I bought at the age of 4 and a half or so, had my parents bought for me, of course, but I'm sure I probably spotted the cover and had them and said, that's the one I want. That's how it happened, but exactly why it happened, I'm afraid only my psychologist or psychiatrist could know for sure if I had one.
Roy, in your dedication to the first edition of the All-Star Companion, you dedicated the book to your mother, Leona Thomas, who bought you your first issue of All-Star off the newsstand. Do you remember what issue that was?
Well, as I said, the first one that I'm absolutely sure I saw was number 25, which, interestingly, was the very first issue after the lineup had kind of standardized with Green Lantern and Flash returning. And I may have seen 24. I'm not sure. I saw ads for it when I was a kid. I may have seen it first, too. That would have been really early. That would have been when I was not even 4 and a half yet or something. But it was one of those two, 24 or 25. 25 at least. I'm just not sure about 24. And so that goes back to about, you know, age 4 and a half. I wasn't reading them then, of course. I could just look at the pictures.
Roy, is it really true that your mother never made you throw away any of your comic books?
Not 100% true. I think there was a paper drive once when I was in grade school, and I had to donate something to that. I don't know if they were really looking for paper or just trying to get comic books away from kids. But I had to get rid of some of those very, very reluctantly. I did not see any reason to have to do so. And I managed to actually bring home two or three that somebody else threw away. Other than that, I was able to keep them all. I cut up a lot of them over the years, and a lot of them went lost or got torn up from overreading, but I ended up, you know, keeping a lot of them all the way through the 40s and the 50s.
Roy, of all the great Justice Society adventures that appeared in All-Star Comics, did you have a favorite?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to say. The Solomon Grundy story was a favorite because I like that, the look of that character. The two stories with the Injustice Society were certainly favorites of mine, and the one number 35, which turned out to be John Broome's first, the story with the Degaton villain, the time travel, that was a favorite also. So it was in that, you know, that period where the best of them, though there were some good ones before and a couple of good ones under Julian Broome later.
Did you have a favorite cover of All-Star Comics?
No, I don't really know if I did. I mean, I loved the cover with Superman and Batman on it, but the story itself, you know, was not one of the very best. I know I was really struck by issue 37, the first Injustice Society story, because not only were these villains on it, but of course the heroes were bound. That was the first time I think the heroes were ever shown, you know, tied and helpless on All-Star cover. And that was kind of a shockeroony, I remember, you know, the All-Star 33 with the Solomon Grundy cover, and of course I love that Hourglass cover on number 35. Those were probably my, you know, my very, very favorite covers.
Roy, the JSA had a continuous run from All-Star number 3 in the winter of 1940 until All-Star 57 in 1951. Why do you think the JSA failed to maintain a reader base towards the end of the Golden Age when the title was eventually dropped? Actually changed to All-Star Western, and the superheroes dropped after issue number 57.
Superheroes all kind of generally faded after the war. You know, even Superman and Batman and certainly Wonder Woman were not nearly as popular that period. Most of the others disappeared entirely by the early to middle 50s. Captain Marvel might not have if not for the lawsuit, but, you know, by the mid-50s, even Plastic Man was gone, and there was practically nobody left. So I suppose the Justice Society, while it lasted longer than most of the superhero books, shouldn't have been considered immune to that. It was a combination of changing tastes, and I sort of concur or agree with Jerry Bales' view that the that the books were probably still making a profit, and then to some extent there may have been just a conscious decision to try to see if they could come up with something that would be even better. So they would take the titles like All-American and All-Star and turn them into Westerns or something, and with the idea that would do better. And, well, you know, the All-Star Western did last about as many issues in number as the Justice Society had. It was almost exactly the same, maybe one or two more. Although, of course, by that it came out more frequently, so therefore for a shorter period of time, and slightly, and also, but you know, some of those didn't work either because All American Western very quickly faded and was replaced by a war comic within a short order. I think they were just floundering a little after the war, trying to figure out some way to get things that sold better. So they were trying humor and westerns and all sorts of other things. And while I don't think the superheroes ever lost as much favor as quite as it made show by the cancellation of books, I think that DC just felt it was better trying to put its money somewhere else.
Roy, let's shift gears for just a second and talk about the All-Star Companion you published in 2000, actually published by Tomorrow's Publications, the group that puts that great book out and the Alter Ego magazine out. Was that a lifelong dream of yours to see that in print?
No, I can't say until recent years I ever seriously thought about doing it that much because Jerry Bales had his small magazine back in '62, the first Index All Star, and at that time, and also when when Craig Delick, Delich's with his brother publishing, did the their All Star Index publication, whatever it was called, in the late '70s. It seemed to me like that kind of took care of it in a certain way, so I wasn't really thinking about it until I started doing Alter Ego and having all these articles and wanting to cover the JSA, and it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, maybe they would be a good subject for a book. And after that, things fell into place very nicely. Even a couple of decisions we had to do, things we had to do for legal reasons, turned out to be advantageous to the book, I think, as far as the way it came out and the way that I now am happy that it came out.
How many updates have there been to the All-Star Companion since the original edition published in 2000?
Well, just one second edition with most of the corrections put in. I did put over several issues of Alter Ego, I would mention some of the corrections that I or other people, first that I and then that other people came up with, either real corrections or in some cases more like additions, and I would publish those in little sections in Alter Ego. I did three or four of those in the months right after the book came out, and then in volume two I went back and I worked in virtually all of those and added a couple of photographs of a couple of people, including in particular Arthur Petty, who did the penciling, you know, in most of the last couple of years of All-Star Comics, and then a picture of Dick Dillon because he had done so many JLA-JSA team-ups and was mentioned prominently, and I hadn't had a photograph of him in the first edition. And that was about it. I still found out that I missed, you know, one or two little things here and there, and I'll mention those in Volume 2 when it comes out in the spring.
When in the spring will that be coming out?
Well, it's supposed to be out about March, I guess.
Oh, I know where all the...
I just need a few weeks to work on it, but because I'm working on a couple of, in addition to Alter Ego and a little bit of comics work, I'm also doing, a hardcover book that'll be sold on the newsstands next year, so I'd have to finish that by the end of the summer, and then I'm going to spend a few weeks working pretty exclusively on All-Star Companion Volume 2 so that I can get that out by March, which is the hard date, and I hope I don't have to move it any further back from that.
Roy, let's shift gears for a few minutes and talk about Alter Ego magazine. I know you've been involved in working with Alter Ego since the 60s with Jerry Bales, and that for the last number of years you've been publishing it very regularly. Tell us what we can expect to see in Alter Ego and some of your upcoming issues.
Well, of course, the issue that's on sale right now is the... an issue which centers on the Human Torch and Carl Burgess as its creator. We have an interview with his daughter, and I was particularly pleased that we had a couple of dozen sketches of the Submariner and Human Torch ideas for covers, splash pages, and house ads that Robert Wiener sent me that that we can use. They've never been, for the most part, seen, and this is art that was produced no later than, say, early 42, maybe in some cases, you know, in 40, 41. And while we can't be 100% certain who did them, it was done by, you know, people who were some of the artists working on the strips then, the Human Torch and Submariner. So that was a big thrill. And the issue that's coming out in July is issue number 50, and also it's the July is the 40th anniversary of when I went to work for Marvel. DC was at the end of June, you know, a couple of weeks earlier. And so I decided that this would be a good time to combine those two and have a special issue that's, you know, mostly devoted to my career. I have articles in there about this and that, about All-Star Squadron or about this or that artist or subject matter, but I haven't really been the major, you know, focus of an issue, so I decided, well, I'm going to do it just this once, and then I'll go back to dealing with other people for the next 50 issues or so again. Well, and I was kind of pleased with the way that turned out, too. After that, we've got interviews with Joe Giella and Luther Schwartz, who was the Batman ghost from 1946 to 1953, or some cover dates, 54 probably. And we have a lengthy interview coming up, probably spread over two issues, with Mike Esposito of the Andrew Esposito team, and who, of course, inked for Marvel later. And he's a great raconteur with a lot of stories. I've got a Halloween issue that Pictured Anna and I will be talking about, and our editor, Mark Beasley, will be talking about the Stoker's Dracula book, which is coming out this fall, I guess, as a trade paperback, or the graphic novel that we had always designed it to be. Of course, the comic issues came out in last year and this year. And it also has more comic strips prepared but never published by Dick Briefer of Frankenstein and a few other little items here and there. So, you know, we'll have a Christmas issue, and we've got some a couple of rare interviews coming up with people who were on staff editorially at DC back in the 40s, and of course that's always great to run to somebody. People who work as editors in many cases have even more to say about more things than people who are writers and artists, because they were more likely to be central to things. You know, they were dealing with a lot of writers, a lot of artists, and they were in the office maybe 5 days a week or thereabouts. And things of that sort will sometimes enable somebody to have a nice perspective and an overall view, which is sort of what I did in my issue number 52, because I was working in the office most of the time. I could talk about a lot of things that, you know, other people who are drawing or writing by themselves wouldn't have run into.
Roy, 40 years is an awfully long time to work in any business, and in particular the comics industry. How did it feel after 40 years to have been involved in such a wonderful industry, such as the comic book industry? I know you've met a lot of people, and you've done a lot of great things, and met a lot of great writers. Of course, you're a great writer yourself, so how does it feel after 40 years of being in the comic industry?
Well, it was mostly, you know, fun. I mean, there's good times, there's bad times, but overall it was a very positive experience, and I still enjoy working with people, the older people, the new people, whatever, you know, when I get a chance. But of course, I'm kind of a dinosaur now, and so, you know, I don't get that much chance to do that much now, but I think that has as much to do with the prejudices of the staff as it does with potential sales.
Roy, I noticed in issue 49 of Alter Ego, Jerry Robinson made an announcement about the Bill Finger Memorial Writers Award. Looks like it'll be given away at the San Diego Comic-Con this July. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's just an idea that different people have had this idea. Jerry is one of several people who suggested a Bill Finger Award to recognize writing. They decided to recognize two writers. One would be a deceased writer, and the other would be someone who is still around, whether he's active or not. And those awards, I guess, they're known, but I'm not going to mention them because they're being formally announced at the San Diego Convention in a few weeks. But, you know, I was kind of pleased. And we always thought calling it the Finger Award was a good idea, you know, because, you know, Bill was, you know, one of the, maybe after Jerry Siegel, created the best-known character around, and yet his name was never attached to it in the same way that, say, Jerry Siegel's was for the first several years, and then became again years later. So he sort of became a representative, rather emblematic of the comics industry and what it did to its earliest creators, by and large. And Jerry wanted to do this, and since he knew Bill personally and was carrying the ball, others of us went in, and you know, we cooperated. I think that Mark Evanier and Denny O'Neill and I were probably some of the people that he was talking to the most to come up with this. I'm not sure how the exact, you know, voting, you know, was done or whatever. It's just a few people. It's not something where you hand out a ballot to everybody who walks in the door. It was just a few people. How it'll be handled in future years, I don't really know. But I think it's kind of nice to give some recognition to writers of the past who made a contribution. Bill Finger would be probably one of the first recipients of the Bill Finger Award, but we figured, well, you know, he's already there, so we won't give him one.
Roy, do you have a personal favorite Golden Age writer?
Well, I suppose because he did All-Star and Hawkman and various books, probably Gardner Fox. But the thing is, you know, a lot of different people were writing good stuff then. Bob Kaniger, John Broome, and, you know, people at other companies, Otto Binder and Bill Woolfolk and others at Fawcett and so forth. There were, and a lot of other people whose names I don't really know, or maybe they were also the artists, like Jack Cole or Will Eisner. You know, there were so many people, it's hard to have a favorite. Gardner would certainly have been would have been at or near the top of the list, except, of course, I didn't really know when I was a kid that he did the Justice Society, because his name was only ever on, say, the Flash strip, and that he also did a lot of Hawkman or Justice Society, let alone other things. You know, none of us had any way of knowing. It's only in retrospect that you realize how much some of these people did of your favorite books when you finally, you know, find out what the credits were.
Roy, do you have any other Golden Age projects coming up on the horizon that we can look forward to?
Not too much. I'm sort of working off and on another story about the hero alter ego, and that takes place in a universe where the Golden Age heroes are real, and that'll be out one of these days. Not exactly Golden Age, but taking place in the 40s is the strip I originally did for Spain called Anthem, which is kind of a superhero group in an alternate version of World War II, and that's finally going to be published starting at the turn of 2006 by Heroic Publishing. That grew out of my frustration with trying to get an All-Star Squadron or Invaders series to cover that kind of material. I still think that a series of that sort could be done, too, different enough from this that I'd still love to do it, but since I just wasn't getting anywhere, then I went off and when I got a chance from the Spanish company to do it there, so that'll be reprinted in this country. Other than that, of course, I'm putting most of my eggs in the All-Star Companion Volume 2 basket, you know, behind a wraparound cover by Carlos Pacheco that's really very good, and you know, a lot of contributions from various people. That book will deal mostly with either the 1940s characters or with the 1980s All-Star Squadron and its 1940s roots. Those would be the main focuses of the book. Not the 80s book itself alone, but the 1940s roots of it, since so many stories in All-Star Squadron were derivative of, or derived from, or explained things that happened back in the 40s.
Roy, we look forward to all of those projects you've got coming up, and certainly we appreciate all the time and effort you put into the Golden Age of Comics through the publication of Alter Ego Magazine, through the publication of the All-Star Companion, and through all of the other endeavors that you are involved in on a day-to-day basis for the Golden Age of Comics and comic books generally. So thank you very much for your time, and we'll look forward to talking to you next time. Well, that's our show for the second installment of the Golden Age of Comics podcast. I hope everyone learned a little bit about the Golden Age of Comics, and hopefully next time we'll have even more information to share about more Golden Age of Comics trivia, comics, artists, writers, etc. I would encourage everyone to visit our website at goldenagecomics.org. Also, don't forget about the Grand Database Comic Book Project at comics.org. Thanks again for joining us, and again, special thanks to Roy Thomas for joining us on the show. Until next time.